It was 1968. Well, let's make that July 1968. And I had just graduated from the University of Nebraska in marketing and advertising. I graduated summa cum laude, by the way. No, I didn't like school. I didn't like high school. I didn't like college. But you had to do what you had to do. And there I was with a degree, and it was time to get a job. First of all, what was I interested in? Well, forever, I had always been interested in the airlines, and I thought I could be a pretty good advertising guy at an airline. So that's basically what my cover letter said. Along with the resume, it went out to a bunch of airlines like Eastern, remember them, or Allegheny, or Piedmont, or Northwest Orient. Gong. They flew the Rim, Pacific Rim, to Japan and China and all over the place. I thought that'd be cool. My favorite was Pan Am. I loved the white hats and the double-breasted blazers. And they always got the first plane, the first new plane the Boeing ever made. And, you know, they measure airplane speeds in knots, and that comes from Pan Am, because Pan Am originally had flying boats, and boats went across the sea in terms of knots. So that's where that weaseled its way into the airline industry. Then there was MUSAIR. That was a little blip down in Texas for people who wanted to be on an airplane with no smokers. Used to amuse me because in my flying days, we might have to hold short and watch a MUSAIR take the runway and the pilots would be smoking. That was funny. Then Texas International, they were a little regional carrier. And the more frustrated I got, the more red my face got. And that might match one of Braniff's pastels. Braniff Airlines had a whole bunch of pastel airplanes, so I applied there. Ozark was flying around our part of the world. PSA was a California airline. And we had Air California out there as well. National, big one flying the East Coast up and down to Florida and back. And, of course, Air Florida and TWA. Well, all of those went out, and they all come back with the same answer. No thanks. We don't need you. That really frustrated me. I had a one-inch binder sitting on my nightstand that was full of no's. And finally, I got really frustrated about it. I said, what can I do that can get me a job? I looked around my room. Yes, I was home by then. I was mowing greens at the golf course, and my dad was kind of supervising all of that. And in my corner was my trusty Remington shotgun. So I did a little research. I'd bought a Remington 870 a few years earlier. It was brand new, and I paid like $90 for it. It wasn't a real fancy shotgun, but it was plenty reliable. And I was probably shot a couple hundred rounds for it and had a couple of pheasants and a goose to show for it. So anyway, that I enjoyed hunting. I enjoyed the outdoors. I wasn't so crazy about fishing, but the hunting part was cool. So we're going to do something different this time. No letter, no resume. My mom collected every shirt box that had ever been under her Christmas tree. So I went up to her shirt box collection, and I got one. Then I had to go downtown. I had to buy some balsa wood. I had to buy some illustration board that you could paint on. I had to get some paints over at the drugstore and some brushes, and came back, and I sat down, and I illustrated a hunter in a blind shooting at three ducks that were coming in. And I handled, lettered on that little billboard, shoot the best, Remington. I built a frame around that little guy. And I also built a couple of posts. And those posts were glued to two mouse traps that were in the shirt box. So I loaded the mouse trap, and I pushed the billboard down into the box. By the way, the billboard had my resume attached to the back of it. And I closed the box and taped it shut. Then I called Remington. I got the receptionist and I said, "Who's the director of advertising at Remington Arms Company?" She said, "That would be Jack Mitchell." I said, "Where would Mr. Mitchell be?" And she gave me the address, and I put that on the box, okay? And down to the post office, gave it to Fritz Stevens, figured out how much it was going to cost, and off it went. Well, I mowed greens for another week, didn't hear anything. Then Dad came up. I was mowing number 6 green, which was right next to his street. And he said, "You have a call from Tony Konzerski at Remington Arms Company." I said, "No kidding." So I jumped away from the mower, hopped in the truck, went down to the garage, went into Dad's office, and made the call. And he said, "We would like you to come in for an interview. We're going to send you a ticket to fly into Bridgeport. Well, you're going to fly into New York City, but you're going to take Connecticut limousine to Bridgeport to the Holiday Inn. That's their drop-off point anyway. And there's a room waiting for you, and I'll pick you up the next day." So I did all of the above, flew United DC-8 into New York, landed at Kennedy, and came into Bridgeport, got into my room, spent the night. Tony showed up the next day. So he was a cigar-smoking, kind of a short guy, but I really liked him. He had a great personality. We got in. I went through some paperwork stuff, and then he took me down to Mr. Mitchell's office. And I walked in there. He told me to sit down, which I did. They always told me in interview school that don't sit until they tell you. So I didn't sit until Mr. Mitchell told me to sit. I couldn't help but notice on the credenza behind him was my package. And the billboard was sticking up in the air. He looked at me and he said, "Son, that's the most creative thing I think I've ever seen. When I opened that box and that thing flipped up, your resume went shooting right by my right ear. And I thought, if I survived a heart attack, I'm going to hire this kid." And that's exactly what he did. So after all of that, here I was, about 800 miles away from Remington Arms Company, and they wanted to know, how soon could I be there? Well, it didn't take long. That's one of the first chapters in my newest book that I hope to finish this winter. It's called The Business Baron of Bridgeport. I think you'll enjoy it. So thanks. You have a great day. Bye. This is the story of a young Texas guy who had just graduated from the University of Texas in Austin with a degree in journalism. Unlike most Texas kids, he didn't waste his time talking about the greatness of Texas football or waste his time playing video games. He wanted to be a great journalist. In fact, he spent time watching Edward R. Murrow videos. He also watched early episodes of Geraldo at Willowbrook, which made his career. And of course, if you're from Texas, you had to watch the Dan Rather video where he tied himself to a flagpole during a hurricane in Houston. He knew that he needed a big story to make his career. And if he was going to be a journalistic sensation, he'd have to do it on his own. So he put on his best pair of Wrangler leather tab pants, a Texas t-shirt, his boots, and his white straw hat, went out to his Ford pickup, and started on the road to greatness. His first stop was a hint about Grandma Kowalski. Apparently, she was in her late 90s. And her latest pair of false teeth was a lizard line pair. He'd never heard of lizard line false teeth, so that had to be a great story. So he went off to Granby, Texas, found the grandma's home, and he noticed there was a big bunch of cars waiting outside. So he thought, well, maybe I'm late. I don't know. So he goes up and he knocks on the door. And a man in a suit came to the door. He said, I'd like to interview Grandma Kowalski about her lizard false teeth. The man said, you're a little late. She passed away. Apparently, the lizard false teeth had an afterbite. He also knew that in West Texas, there's a big drought going on. So he thought, well, there has to be some stories out there. So he got in his pickup, gassed it up, and headed west. And when he reached Midland, he noticed a line of storms, and it was just pouring. The drought had ended. So there he was in West Texas with no story. He thought, well, maybe I just need to go back to school and do something else. And he pulled into a gas station. And while he was gassing up the car, he noticed these two ranchers were talking about a hero pig. So that piqued his attention a little bit. He listened carefully as the guys were laughing and said, yeah, that hero pig got him out of the house when there was a fire. And he put the gas pump back, and he walked over to the guys and he said, where's this hero pig at? And he said, well, you go 2 miles out of town, you turn to the left, you go another mile and a half on a dirt road, turn to the right, go down this little dirt path to this small house, and that's where the hero pig lives. So the guy says, this has to be a great story. So he hops in his truck, he goes down the road, takes the left, takes the right, goes down the dirt road, takes another turn past a little lake, and boom, there's the house. Up on the porch, a guy is sitting with two little girls. So he gets out of his truck, walks up to the porch, and he said, hi, do you know anything about a hero pig? Guy's in a rock chair, and he said, yep, I sure do. He's right here. So he whistles, and pretty soon, this pig comes to the door. He's going, oink, 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 and comes out of the door. And the kid looks at him and said, he's only got three legs. Well, he wasn't going to be rude and ask him about that. He said, how come this pig is a hero pig? The guy said, well, it all started when he was a little pig. The girls were little back then, too. And one of them crawled off here into the pasture. And she come face to face with a rattlesnake. And this rattlesnake had all curled up and rattling away, was about ready to bite her. So the little pig comes out of the house, and he sees what's going on. And he goes, oink, 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 and he runs across the pasture, jumps through the air right onto this rattlesnake and kills it. Even though the rattlesnake bit him like three times, his hide is as tough as a rubber hose, so it didn't hurt him any. So the kid's writing this down in his reporter's notebook, and he says, is that how he lost his leg? Oh, no, no. And there was another time, a real cold front came down from the north, and it froze the lake a little bit. Not a lot, you know. Ice is always closest to the shoreline. And one of these other girls walks out on the ice while I was in town. And she goes too far out, and the ice got thin, and she fell through. So she's half drowning out there. The little pig sees what's going on. He runs across the yard again, runs across the ice, squats down on his paws, and grabs the girl by the hair and pulls her out and saved her life again. So the kid asks, well, did the little pig freeze his leg or something? He said, no, 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 no. And, just a couple weeks ago, we had a fire here in the house. And the kid says, yeah, I heard that down at the gas station. He looked around the old man, and sure enough, half of the house was gone. It was burned up. They're just sitting on the porch. And they could smell, from the the fire and so forth. And he said, what happened here? And he said, well, during the night, one of the girls knocked over a lantern and started the house on fire. And they was both sleeping pretty hard. I was still in town at work. So the little pig, he starts squealing and raising hell and gets the girls out of the house just in time for the fire department to show up and save what's left. So the reporter kid says, is that how the pig lost his back leg? And the farmer says, oh, no, you just don't eat a hero pig like that one at a time. We were at 41,000 feet. And I was flying 100 Whiskey November, my beautiful Learjet, from Austin, Texas to New York City. On board today was Connie, which was Willie's third wife. She was headed for a little personal shopping in New York City and decided to come up and chat with Marty and I. I don't know how we got onto the subject, but I was telling her about one of my experiences when I was 3 years old. My mom and dad had just bailed me out of the polio ward out of a hospital in Sioux City, Iowa. I survived it. This was before the shot. So anybody that got polio got put into an isolation ward. They took you away from your parents and you couldn't see your parents. And there's only one way that you came out of there, or actually two ways that you came out of there. You got over it or you died. In my case, I got over it. There was some damage to me, to my left arm, and that would kind of motivate me or haunt me, whichever you'd like, for the rest of the time that I spent on this planet. But today, Mom and Dad were getting away. They were going to a rock concert in Sioux City, and the rocker was Spike Jonze. That was back in 1949, long time ago, huh? Charlene Lux was the babysitter, I think. I'm not sure of that, but I believe so. And I did my best to scoot around and escape her. And I went out the back door of the house, wasn't paying too much attention, ran out into the street, and I got hit by a 1949 Packard. That's a car, in case you didn't know that. Back in those days, the cars had these up and down devices on the grill called bumper guards. They were probably 6 inches, 8 inches high, and were covered in chrome and just made the car look all spiffy and pretty. The bumper guard caught my jacket. So now you can picture a big old car with a bumper guard with a kid being hung from it. And an old lady driving this big old car down the street didn't realize she had hit a kid. Well, next door neighbor Phyllis was washing her dishes and looked out the window, and to her horror, she sees the big old car go by with a kid hanging on the bumper. She dropped everything, ran out of the door, screaming across the yard, "You've hit a child! You've hit a child!" The lady pops the clutch. The jacket tears, and under the car I go. Fortunately, the tire missed me, or this podcast wouldn't be happening, I'm sure. Anyway, I was telling this story to Connie, and she was just roaring about it. It was sort of funny in a strange sense of the word. But I said, Mom and Dad got to the concert and got seated. Spike Jonze came out on the stage and said, "I have an emergency telephone call for Mr. Ken Miller. I'm Kenny, the son." So they get the emergency telephone call, jump into the car, and drive back to Hardington, Nebraska. That's where we lived, a little town in the northeast part of the state. And in front of the house was the volunteer fire truck and a hearse from the funeral home. The door of the hearse was open. Back in those days, we didn't have fancy ambulances in small towns. The funeral home took care of that job, and they used their hearse to do it. So Mom didn't know what to think. She was just ballistic when she got out of the car. They had to drag her into the house because she thought little Kenny had bought it. He was dead. But there I sat on the top of the couch, shirt off, a little whimper, I'm sure, and Dr. Dorsey was working on me. If you think Milburn Stone from Gunsmoke, that was Dr. Dorsey. Back in those days, the only thing you could do for a bunch of busted ribs was tape them. So he had me all taped up and ready to live another 70-some years. Connie just loved that story. She was laughing, and I still do. Sniff a little bit when I remember it. So we got to New York. Connie went off on her shopping trip. A couple days later, we were on the way back to Austin with a Learjet full of boxes and presents and everything else. And she came up to the front and she says, "I have something for you." And inside of a shopping bag was a copy of an album that was still in a cellophane. And it was the best of Spike Jones. And she said, "Give this to your mother and tell her I was sorry she missed the concert, but she can still go if she wants." You have a great day. Bye.